Welcome this afternoon to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case scheduled for 1:30 and another case scheduled for 3, so we'll break after this case, assuming it doesn't last till 3. I don't think it will. I'm Justice Gardner, and to my right is Justice Meyer, and to my left is Bill. Okay. Bill? And to my left is Justice Lee Gabriel, and we're your panel for today. The first case up is Thomas S. Byrne versus Sealcraft Corporation and the Gray Insurance Company, and I'll ask the clerk to call the case, please. Our counsel, are you ready to begin, Mr. Spence? Okay. Proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Joe Spence, together with co-counsel Mark Stoker. We're here representing Thomas Byrne, the appellant, the plaintiff below. I'd be remiss if I didn't start off by saying that this is somewhat of a unique situation where you have the appellant as the plaintiff below who lost on jury questions, had negative jury answers to the two liability questions that went before the jury, but nonetheless comes before the appellate court and says, basically, we should disregard those no answers. We should have won as a matter of law. Certainly on liability, it's our position on liability and our remedy for damages, attorney's fees included. But admittedly, that's a fairly unique situation, but I think it really is one of those cases where that's exactly what could have happened. I think, in fact, this case probably could have been decided below on cross motions for summary judgment due to the specific language and the liability of both of these appellees and defendants under, in one case, the indemnity clause in the subcontract, which relates to Sealcraft, and the language of the performance bond, which relates to Gray Insurance. And so I guess I'll just get right to it and tell the court why Byrne believes that both of these appellees were liable under these agreements. And first, let's go to Gray Insurance and their liability. Gray was the surety on a performance bond that was issued in connection with this project. The performance bond is Plaintiff's Exhibit 3. We attach it as Exhibit 2 to our appendix, I believe. And what's interesting about the performance bond is that there's unique language in that bond that triggers Gray's liability. And that language specifically, it says Gray agrees in the event of a breach of the subcontract by Sealcraft. And then in paren, interesting language, it says, as determined in the sole discretion of contractor, in this case, Byrne. And that's critical language in this performance bond, because what that means, the plain language, and not ignoring the plain language, as I believe appellees want to do, is that creates liability on behalf of Gray under this performance bond if Byrne, in its sole discretion, determined that Sealcraft, in this case, Sealcraft was the one manufacturing and installing the windows at Montgomery Plaza, that if Byrne, in its sole discretion, determined that Sealcraft was in breach of the subcontract, that triggers Gray's obligation. Now, admittedly, there's language above that has five separate conditions that the appellees relied on in their appellee's brief and their SIR reply. That talks about various conditions have to be met. The first condition is essentially that if Sealcraft has fully and faithfully performed all of the subcontract and the other four conditions are met, then the obligation under the bond is essentially extinguished. And I don't deny that those conditions are in there or that language is in there, but I think where the appellees misstep is their argument that they just want to ignore this language that triggers Gray's liability. I think those two have to be read together. So in this case, the first condition was not met, and the reason it wasn't met and could not be met as a matter of law, because in the course of the performance of this contract, Byrne determined in its sole discretion that that Sealcraft was in breach of the subcontract.
Well, counsel, how do you reconcile that interpretation with the fact that the jury found or failed to find that Sealcraft breached the contract?
Well, I have two responses to that, Your Honor. First, I think the most important thing is that it, as certainly as it relates to Gray, the need for Byrne to go into a civil court of law and obtain a jury finding on breach of contract is irrelevant or immaterial or not required to trigger Gray's obligation.
But I thought that the law was pretty well settled that under the performance bond, liability of the principal is
derivative,
secondary, that it has to be established first.
I think that is the general rule. In the Right Way case, I believe we cite to, and I think the appellees cite to, I think that is the general rule. But the Right Way case goes on to say that the specific language in the bond is also important in determining the surety's liability. And so in this case, I think that the sole discretion provision, as I call it, essentially trumps this concept of derivative, or maybe a better way of saying it is that it defines as if and when Gray is going to have derivative liability. And their derivative liability in this case is still going to be based on the liability of Sealcraft, but it's in the sole discretion or determination of Byrne. And so that, to me, is the difference, is that if it wasn't that, then essentially it would eviscerate or nullify that clause.
Well, let me ask you this. Suppose that there's another reasonable interpretation of that clause, in that it seems to me that in many, if not most, and I'm not an expert, I'm just that most that I've seen, performance bonds, the contractor, Byrne, gets to elect whether to, once the subcontractor defaults, gets to elect whether to finish the subcontractor's work itself or call upon the surety to step in and take over and finish it. Isn't that what the sole discretion refers to, that the contractor gets to determine either to commence, whether it itself is going to commence to timely and fully complete, or at its option, the contractor will call upon the surety to perform?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I think the reason, first and foremost, is that this sole discretion language is in a parenthetical right after where it says the surety further agrees in the event of a breach of the subcontract on the part of the principal, i.e. Sealcraft, paren, as determined in the sole discretion of the contractor, close paren. And I think just the grammatical interpretation there would mean that that has to modify this determination of whether Sealcraft was in fact in breach of the contract. And the other thing about, back to the jury question issue, if a jury question in a civil proceeding that Sealcraft was in breach is required to Byrne, they have to go through a court of law, get a jury finding that says Sealcraft was in breach to trigger the obligation under the bond, then that would essentially eliminate the sole discretion provision, because Sealcraft would, or Byrne would still have to say, well, even though we've determined in our sole discretion that Sealcraft is in breach of the subcontract, under the bond, we still have to file a suit, get a jury to determine there is a breach before that provision would be triggered.
Do you think that then that jury question number one didn't even need to be submitted, that it wasn't essential to liability of Gray?
Yes, Your Honor. Not as to Gray's liability. Certainly as to Sealcraft's liability. But as to Gray, you're correct. That is our position.
Okay. One more comment, and then I'm sorry, I'm taking up too much of your time.
Fine.
I'll give you a few minutes extra if you want. That don't we have to look at the document as a whole and construe this at the discretion language so as to be in harmony with the purpose of the contract, which is a surety agreement,
Yes, Your Honor. Secondary agreement. Yes, and I believe we do. And to me, that again, back referring to in the language of the bond, it's the third full paragraph that lists these various conditions, one through five, of if these are fulfilled, then the bond, Gray's liability on the bond might be extinguished. I think those are the things that have to be harmonized with the sole discretion provision, and I think that's what that's our position, is that we're harmonizing them by saying that, well, if the sole discretion provision is never triggered, and it ultimately the Sealcraft fully and faithfully performs under condition one, which is shall faithfully perform the subcontract in every particular, et cetera, then absolutely Gray would have been off the hook. I think the appellees are the ones that don't want to harmonize this because they only want to point to the conditions and want to ignore the sole discretion clause. And that's a key principle of contract construction. You can't construe it to eviscerate a clause altogether. You're supposed to harmonize them and make them live together. And I think they can live together. But in this case, on a chronological basis, what happened first is that Byrne determined in its sole discretion, and I don't really think anybody disputes it, these windows were leaking like crazy and Sealcraft hadn't performed. The rest of the liability for Gray was there was no question a notice letter was sent. That's Plaintiff's Exhibit 5, 72208 letter to Gray. Gray clearly didn't comply within 7 days to come in and fix things. In fact, Defendant's Exhibit 133 is a letter from Gray where they just denied all liability. And there's no dispute that Byrne, through DGB Glass, went ahead and fixed the windows that were in question at that time.
Mr. Spence, I have a little bit more to talk to you about on the sole discretion language in the performance bond. We look at the language and take it for what it says unless someone claims it's ambiguous. And there was no ambiguous claim made in this case.
I believe that's correct.
Was Byrne exercising its sole discretion when it determined that there was a need for repairs to be made before the ultimate closing of the exterior contract and asked Sealcraft to do some work on repairing the windows? Was that a sole discretion matter? In other words, you've got some leaks, we want you to fix them. And that happened first. Sealcraft did the work on those. And then you went through another process in which the whole of the building project on the exterior work contract, exterior contract, was accepted by the owner and fully paid Byrne, and Byrne fully released the, took money out of the holdbacks.
Correct, Your Honor.
And then paid the rest of the holdbacks to Sealcraft. Now, was that an exercise of the sole discretion of the Thomas Byrne in deciding at that point that the leaks were fixed?
No, Your Honor. I don't know how to answer that without referring back to the issue of substantial completion and their argument that that somehow ended everything and that therefore all liability under the bond, and that would include a sole discretion provision, was ended.
Well, I'm not looking at the arguments that's in the appellee's brief. I'm talking about the language that's in your brief. It talks about the circumstances of the events that occurred prior to the time that in 2008 a demand letter was written, whenever all these other things happened in advance of that. And I'm just asking you, if you apply sole discretion to these other conduct, other events of acts made by Thomas Byrne in the process of dealing with Sealcraft on this project. In other words, to me, if you're going to look at sole discretion only as defining a breach, then whenever you take actions that are not consistent with your belief that there was a breach, payments, closing of a transaction, certificate of completion, finish the contract. All of those, to me, are part and parcel of what's in your briefing about the timeline of events.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm trying to understand how you can say, well, the sole discretion only applies to this one determination of a breach that's after all these other discretionary decisions were made to finalize and finally pay and close the contract.
I understand your question, Your Honor, now. I apologize. I didn't quite get it, but I get it. First and foremost, the sole discretion provision, we believe, is limited, and that term and concept is limited to the determination of whether Sealcraft was in breach of the subcontract. That's the limiting scope of it within the bond. But to answer your question, I do think that the evidence does show that in 06, when Curtain Wall Design was called out and gave two options to Sealcraft, and they chose the option to wet seal and they wet sealed. The building sat empty for a while. Phase two began. When my client went back in phase two, they saw leaks again. At that point, they called out, and in fact, Sealcraft called out ATI again. There's no question there were leaks. There were 80 leaks that were repaired. At that time, there were 866 more leaks that were present. And so the answer is, to answer the justice question, I think what happened is, at that time, Byrne did send a letter to Sealcraft, 4-8 of 08, it's Plaintiff's Exhibit 7, said, hey, we've got problems again. And they started talking to him, and at that point, Sealcraft said, oh, I'm sorry, I see my time is up. Could I finish your answer?
Go ahead, please finish.
Thank you. And at that time, Sealcraft responded, and Mr. Van Ness, the president, said, well, I don't have any more company, really. I don't have any employees. I don't have anybody that can do that. I'm not really sure, you know, that anything's wrong, et cetera, et cetera. And that's when, at that point, yes, Sealcraft, I mean, Byrne determined in its sole discretion that, you know what, we have 800 more leaking windows out here on the project, and this guy doesn't even have people that can come out and fix it. So, yes, at that point, we did determine that he was in breach of the subcontract.
And it was after that time that the employment was set up for the last company to come out and repair the windows for $50,000.
Correct, Your Honor. DGB Glass. Thank you.
Mr. Krebs? Proceed.
David Krebs, Your Honors, for Sealcraft Corporation and Gray Surety, Gray Insurance Company.
Counsel.
With your permission, I'd like to start with the indemnity argument. I know we've been talking about the bond, and I will return to that quickly. But I'd like to start with the indemnity argument, which has been made, because I think it is key to our position on appeal. Not so much as it was at trial, because at trial, this battle was fought on Article 7.02. Did Sealcraft conform with the contract? And the jury returned a verdict that yes, it did. And I hear an awful lot about 800 leaks, and it's undisputed that these windows leak like crazy. Well, we dispute that strongly, and we disputed it at trial, and we dispute responsibility for the 800 leaks. And the jury resolved those issues in our favor, in favor of Sealcraft Corporation and Gray Surety. So the only issue left here, I think, on breach of contract for Sealcraft is set up in page 22 of appellant's reply brief, where they say, in referencing 7.02 breach of contract, the scope breach, because you know how it is, having tried that, we were sort of vapor locked on that, and we addressed that in our brief. But they came back and said, however, that breach of contract claim, i.e. breach under 7.02, scope of work, is not the subject of Byrne's complaint on appeal. The only breach of contract theory which forms the basis of Byrne's complaint on appeal is Sealcraft's alleged breach of 6.02, i.e. the indemnity clause. And that's what we're talking about first as for breach. The reason I think that's important also from the point of Gray is because our liability is secondary, and I am going to address the whole discretion issue, because we have a different view on that. The appellant's view on indemnity is that although it has been established below that there was no breach of the contract insofar as workmanship or failure to follow plans and specs or any of that, or warranty, all of that is gone for purposes of this appeal. That nonetheless, Sealcraft, and by inference, by reference, by contract, Gray Surety owes indemnity on costs that they incurred, which they initially claimed were a result of Sealcraft's failure to follow scope. In other words, what they are saying is that this indemnity clause swallows the contract, the subcontract, that the whole issue of did you perform properly or did you not perform properly is washed away by this indemnity clause, which says, hey, if I spent money and it's any way related to the work you did, you've got to reimburse me. That's not Texas law. That's not what this subcontract says. The indemnity clause is found in a section on insurance and indemnity, which gives a hint right there, not in a section on default of the subcontract. And Texas law is clear that typically indemnity provisions do not apply to claims between the parties. Indemnity clauses exist to protect from third-party claims. That's the default. That's where you start from. Now, Texas courts enforce agreements between parties, so that if the parties did in fact extend that agreement to include the kind of claims that they're alleging, appellants are alleging, this court would enforce it. But an indemnity clause is, first of all, interpreted in favor of the indemnitor. They are read narrowly. We start from the fact that it is assumed that this clause by law does not apply to third-party claims, does not apply to inter-party claims, unless otherwise specified. There is nothing in this clause to indicate an intent to extend to inter-party claims. There is nothing in this clause to show an intent by Mr. Van Nessa Sealcraft that his subcontract, that his obligations to perform would be washed away by this indemnity, and he would end up as an insurer of whatever Byrne chose to spend. If you look at the Kellogg case, Kellogg versus Ultimania, there's an almost identical clause. The only difference is one of them says any, one of them says all. But I submit to you that's a distinction without a difference, because what the court said is any isn't broad enough. It says what claims are covered, but it doesn't say whose claims are covered. And in order to show inter-party indemnity, you have to say whose claims are covered. There are only two clauses that they cover that have to do with, that have to deal with, there are only two cases they cite that have to do with inter-party indemnity. One is the BP case, in which the indemnity agreement specifically said that it extended to damages to property of BP. Now, the court found properly that that clearly provided for an inter-party claim. But I also point out to the court that wouldn't have covered the damages in this case, even if that were the clause, because they didn't have property damage, the property they owned. The other one was Radiant versus ASI, and in that, the clause specifically provided that it would cover losses from breach of the contract. That clause, although it provided for inter-party agreements, inter-party indemnity, wouldn't cover this situation either. There is no reported case that actually extends an indemnity clause the way that Byrne is seeking to extend it. And this clearly is not broad enough to do that. Now, given that, let's discuss just for a second, if I may, Gray's liability or lack of liability. There was a separate finding by the jury. It wasn't lumped together. There was a separate finding by the jury that Gray had not breached its bond. The appellant's view on the bond, their reading of sole discretion in the third paragraph of the bond would essentially abolish, and I am not exaggerating, 2,000 years of surety law. Not abolish it, but deviate from it. It is absolutely Suretyship is the oldest form of security in the legal system. It is absolutely established that a surety's liability is only derivative, is only secondary. Otherwise, a surety would be an insurer, which it is not. Surety does not buy the claim. Its liability is secondary. Now, if you look at this bond, and it's not the best written bond in the world, or we wouldn't be here. But if you look at this bond, the first paragraph is written in this very arcane language that they always use, and I don't know why, but it's sort of reversed, and it says, now the condition of this bond shall be that if. And it lists five conditions, and it says that if these five conditions are met, this bond is null and void. The first thing that I would suggest to this court is that these conditions were met long before, under these facts, long before Byrne ever decided that it was going to declare a breach. When Byrne, in connection with a totally separate project, called on Gray, the other project was not only complete, the warranty had not only run and, according to the jury, been honored, but this bond, by its terms, had become null and void.
Let me just stop you.
Yes, ma'am.
Question. When you said the warranty had expired, that was one thing that I got confused in reading the briefs, because I believe their position was the warranty had been extended by Sealcraft.
Yes, ma'am. And we questioned Mr. Sawyer at length on that, because there was a 3-year warranty that had been given by Sealcraft. I will point out to the court that warranty excluded installation, removal, and reinstallation of the windows, which was what their demand was. Their demand was outside of the warranty, even if it existed. But Mr. Sawyer, who was their project manager and the first witness they put on, the person they put on to tell the jury about their case, Mr. Sawyer repudiated that warranty, not once, not twice, but 3 times. And I can give you the record sites if you want, because it surprised me at trial that he did. But the reason, of course, he did was because that 3-year warranty excluded what their demand had been, which was remove and reinstall the windows.
So if the warranty was extended, it still excluded what they wanted.
It still excluded, and they repudiated at trial. And it's a hard thing to come back and say a jury or a judge should have ruled otherwise when their position at trial, as put on by the testimony of their witness, was that this 3-year warranty did not apply to us. This was something which was given to the owner. And the owner, of course, Kimco, never made a claim against Byrne. Byrne got paid in full, the job was all done. So I do believe that Mr. Van Ness, or Sealcraft, in fact honored his warranty, and the record shows that every time any kind of call was made on him, he tried to honor his warranty. And in the end, he was prevented from it, although it had expired at the time. So, if I may, returning to the bond for just a minute, my first point is this bond was null and void at the time that they made their demand. But my second point is that this whole reading of sole discretion isn't found up in the first paragraph, which is the trigger of liability. The second paragraph has to do with waiver of common law notices, which is very common in bonds, and these notices that were required go back hundreds of years, and under modern practice now they're generally waived. But the third paragraph has to do with a project which is in which a claim is made on the surety in the middle of performance. And this is always a problem for an obligee on a subcontractor bond, because they're in the middle of a project, the subcontractor, for whatever reason, invariably they say it's not our fault, invariably the general contractor says it is, but they walk off the job, whatever. and the general contractor is left in the middle of an ongoing project with a project that needs to be completed and a subcontract, a portion of it that needs to be completed. And what I submit to you is that although it's not artful, what is being said here in this third paragraph is that if this happens to us, and I think, Justice Gardner, you were, I agree not entirely with what you were saying, but partially with what you're saying about sole discretion, because I think that what's being said here is that if there is a default in the middle of completion, and we call upon you, you are going to come complete. And you're not going to raise technical defenses. You're not going to say you overpaid the subcontractor. You're not going to say the many technical defenses which suretyship is open to. And you're not going to say, I need 4 months to investigate this. You're going to come perform. If we make demand on you, you're going to come perform. I don't read anything in here that says that the surety therefore becomes, for instance, loses its right to later on contest that and say, you made me perform. This is fairly common. Sureties complete all the time under a reservation of rights, saying, we're going to come complete this project because that'll mitigate everybody's damages, but we're going to reserve our right. If our guy wasn't in default, we get our money back. That is as common as can be. And I submit to you that that is essentially what this third paragraph is addressing. And it is putting it in the hands of the general contractor. It's making it the general contractor's decision rather than the surety's decision. If we call on you to complete, by golly, you're going to come complete.
And doesn't that third paragraph only pertain to the original subcontract between Burn and Sealcraft, which had been completed and then a separate?
Yes, ma'am. And that was actually the basis of Gray's original denial, which came like 3 or 4 weeks after the claim was made, said, this project's over. The general contract's complete. You've been paid in full. The obligation that we bonded has been performed, and we're done. And the warranties have expired. Now, later on, as the case developed, it became obvious that Sealcraft had real defenses and hadn't breached. But from a legal point of view, from the point of view of the surety, this project was done. It was complete, and our bond was discharged. The one final thing that I will say to you, we do have a cross appeal, both on the issue of substantial completion, but also on warranty and the failure to plead warranty. I do agree with the appellants that if, in fact, their appeal is limited to breach of indemnity, that moots our whole warranty cross point. So I'll just add that for the court. I see my time's up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Spence, you have rebuttal?
Let me respond to this whole warranty issue, 1 year, 3 year. The appellees didn't mention a three-year warranty in their brief at all, even though it was part of the record. In fact, it was one of their exhibits, Exhibit 80, Defendant's Exhibit 80. Our representative didn't repudiate the three-year warranty. What our representative said over and over was that Byrne never agreed to it, that the architect and the owner are the ones that got with Sealcraft and cut a deal for Sealcraft to extend the one-year warranty to 3 years. That's what he said. But even more important, behind all that, this goes to our point, which is Burns' position is that Sealcraft never complied with its fundamental obligation under the subcontract to provide us with airtight, weathertight windows. And whether a warranty was triggered or came in or these, they want to characterize these warranty claims, our position was wait. You never finished the job correctly. Now, I know their argument about substantial completion, and I'll get to that in just a minute, but let me point to the court. The subcontract 4.03 specifically says, final payment, and remember, final payment, certificate of substantial completion, is the procedure by which you then can get your final payment. It's lumped together. It's part and parcel of the same thing. 4.03, final payment does not relieve Sealcraft's obligation under the subcontract for faulty or defective work appearing after final payment. So when they say, oh, we were done with that subcontract the minute that substantial completion deal came was signed, that's not correct. That's not what the contract documents say. Gray signed a consent for final payment. They went to the surety and said, we're about to make final payment, will you consent to it? And in that provision, which Gray signed, it says, Gray agrees that final payment to the contractor, i.e. Sealcraft, shall not relieve surety company of any of its obligations to Thomas S. Byrne as set forth in the surety company's bond.
But there has to be some end to Sealcraft's responsibility for these defects that are found after final payment. So in your opinion, what is your position of when that finally ended? Is it the warranty term?
Well, I think it ends when they don't complete it and you go through the procedures we went through and you sue them for breach of contract and either win or lose. I mean, I think that's and obviously you're going to have a statute of limitations issue that's going to creep in. But I think that the obligation, if they appear afterwards, if they can, and there's a statute of repose, obviously, but I mean, if it says that things that appear after, then they're obligated under the original contract for that, and they remain obligated. And the irony is, this is the irony of the whole argument they seem to be making. On the one hand, they want to argue, well, by February of 07, everything was extinguished, subcontract and the bond. When we send them a letter in 08 and say, by the way, you need to do this, they come in and say, well, how could you not have given us the opportunity to perform those repairs? And it's like they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. If their obligations were completely extinguished in 07, why would we give them the opportunity to repair? I mean, if they're really saying that. We don't think it was. We think that's why they ignored the three-year warranty, because they wanted a shorter window to say, we're done, we're out of here. But that's really our position, that I think the appellees are either mischaracterizing or not understanding. Finally, when opposing counsel says that these leaks were disputed and there were no leaks that were Sealcraft's obligation, at trial in December of 2011, the appellees called in the current owner essentially to shoot down our claim for any future or continuing repairs. And the current owner said that Sealcraft had just been on the property in December of 2011 and had fixed 80 leaks. The owner said, and Mr. Van Ness agreed with all of this, the owner said there were 200 more leaking windows in December of 2011 that needed to be fixed. And Mr. Van Ness said Sealcraft had agreed to fix all the glazing leaks that continued for the next 3 years. So the problem in this case is in January of 05, May of 05, July of 05, February of 06, early 08, late 08, December of 2011, and beyond. These windows have always leaked. They just leak. And all these maneuvers to say, well, we don't have any obligation to fix them, or if we did, then now that doesn't cover it, it's baffling for them to say that they dispute or that there are no leaks, or it just makes no sense. It's undisputed. Their own client said, yeah, I'm out there fixing leaks. They're my leaks to fix, 2011, even though they say they didn't have any obligation.
Did they say they're my leaks to fix, or did they just say we're going to do it because we're going to do it?
He basically, well, I may have misspoke in the sense I'm paraphrasing, but yes, Mr. Van Ness, we cited this in our brief a couple of times, said, yeah, I feel like it's my obligation to fix these leaks I was responsible for, that I've committed to give them a weather-tight building. And again, my point is, why in 2011, if they weren't his leaks, when they're claiming 5 years earlier his obligations were completely gone, why is he out there fixing leaks 5 years later and now wants to claim he has nothing to do with it and they're not Sealcraft's leaks? That makes no sense. That's my point, Your Honor.
So does the surety bond go on forever until all the leaks are fixed?
In this case, yes. I think it does.
Mr. Spence, does it make a difference of the type of leak that we're talking about in terms of whether it's a leak related to the framing being set properly in concrete as opposed to it being the result of a possible movement of the glass pane itself as far as the framing is concerned, which is what I understand to be the bulk of the claims that were worked on by Sealcoat was that we're talking about glazing leaks, which result from the shifting or the actual set of the glass in the frame, not the other leaks that deal with what might have been done in terms of the concrete preparation of the concrete itself for the setting of the frame.
That's correct, Your Honor. And to the extent does it make any difference, our position is yes, these glazing leaks are peculiarly, can't say that word, Sealcraft's issue. They are the manufacturer of these windows, and a glazing leak is where the pane meets the frame and there's some problem with the sealant or whatever that sealed it. And the fact that, okay, they may have shifted when they moved them in there and sent them in there in 2005, maybe that was the reason why the 05 leaks occurred. But in 2011, when there's 200 more glazing leaks and 80 have just been repaired by Sealcraft, I don't know any other conclusion to reach but for the Sealcraft's windows and their responsibility for those glazing leaks are still present.
Sure.
Thank you to both counsel for good arguments. Appreciate your hard work and very good briefs as well. Your case is submitted and you're excused. Thank you, and we will recess until 3 o'clock.